Good afternoon. My name is David Bick from Square One Consulting. Let me first introduce our panellists. Immediately opposite me, Keith Harris, a long-time investment banker. He's conducted 32 football transactions for football clubs over the last 13 years, starting with Chelsea in 2003, and more recently the majority sale to American buyers of Swansea City in the Premier League. Welcome, Keith. To Keith's right, the only other man in black dark glasses, Richard Green from Hill Dickinson, the lawyers Hill Dickinson, where he is a partner and the head of sport. He too has worked for a number of football clubs, most notably for many years Liverpool. He's also an expert in FA Rule K arbitration, which I've only just learnt is that when there's a contract dispute or an agent dispute, you cannot go to a court of law under the football rules. You have to go to FA Rule K arbitration. And to my immediate left, Tony Evans, football writer and broadcaster, broadcasts with ESPN and BT Sport, formerly the football editor of The Times, and now a columnist with The Evening Standard, and also the author of a number of books on Liverpool. Can we start, gentlemen, perhaps with Keith and Richard, in the light of the topicality of Brexit? What impact, I was going to ask you, Keith, do you think Brexit might have on the transaction of football clubs? And Richard, I was going to ask you the same question in the context of the movement of players.
I'm not sure this is actually... Is it working?
I think you've got to pick it up, Keith. You've got to be close to it, I'm afraid.
There we go. Good afternoon, everyone. This time last week, seems like a long week, I've been invited to go on Sky News at 7 a.m. to discuss the impact of the vote, which going to bed on Thursday night, we all knew was going to be a Remain, to talk about what the remainder of the season, the transfer season and the like was going to have. Well, as it turns out, of course, there was a result that nobody expected in those few hours. And my reflections, having not prepared at all for actually Brexit, came to light. And I think the principal impact on the value of clubs is probably de minimis. But in the meantime, there will be an impact, possible impact, on the ability of clubs to have some of the young stars that have made from overseas that have made such a difference. So four European countries provided four young players last year, Martial for Manchester United, Payet for West Ham, Conte for Leicester, and Lukaku for Everton. And it's questionable whether they could have played. I think whether or not they're in the squads makes a difference to the team performance, not to the value. Of course, for the time being, it has a significant impact on the value, because for any overseas buyer, they've just had to pay 13 or 14% less than they did beforehand at a time when the revenues inexorably arise. Best part of 50 years. There's been maybe two exceptions in that. One in the Euros when we were at home and once in Italy in 1990. 1990 is a quarter of a decade past. And other than that, we have failed miserably, to be frank. And that can't all be blamed on the influx of foreign players into Britain. There must be something more fundamentally damaged in our system. And one of the questions I was discussing last Friday, trying to find a positive for Brexit, was that perhaps if the clubs are not quite as capable of taking young players from overseas, they will put more money into developing their own. Well, actually, you know, if you look at some of the young players in the academies of the clubs that are all now out on loan, and Chelsea has dozens, tens and tens of players on loan. But a club that I've become familiar with recently, Everton's had a long record of developing its own good players. And they seem to play well for their clubs and they flourish. And suddenly when they're put together, whether it's the coaching or whatever else, it all goes horribly wrong?
You know what? I'm sorry, I have to disagree. Gary, good manager, and England go a long way in the tournament. I would have taken them to the semi-finals. You know, a proper manager wins it with this lot. England, it has no effect on the finances of football, really. I would say, in my view, the Football Association is a very flawed entity. What should do is stop trying to make big deals and make money. And what they should do is set themselves up as the moral conscience of the game, the protectors of the laws, the protectors of the fans, and try and get a good manager for the England team. It's that simple. Hodgson's a dope.
But then, Tony, the other issue I think that flows from that is that you have a look at who are the contenders, according to the media, for the job to replace Roy Hodgson. And if you have a look at the English contenders, ignoring anyone from overseas, then there is no one, in my view, that would excite the English public with regards to that post. I mean, you're talking about, as I understand it, the favourite in terms of the odds is Glenn Hoddle. Glenn Hoddle is a man who hasn't had a job for, I think, 20 years in terms of being in charge of a team. He may have done a good job whilst he was with England the last time round, but the game has moved on, and the sad fact of it is that with whatever the FA have introduced, no really good English coaches seem to be out there who are able to step into the shoes of Roy Hodgson. And if people think that the under 21 boss is the good coach, he does not want to have the job. So that is an issue, and that is a fundamental issue that needs to be tackled head on. And I'm afraid that, and we may come on to it, David, but I'll say it now, is that in terms of football in general, there are many, many people within the game, in my view, who have jobs because their friends have jobs and they appoint them to the position, and it does not go on a merit-based achievement or attainment. And until you solve that, you are always going to have this perpetual issue.
Let's turn to that then and start with Keith. To compete at the top level of football now, you need a decent stadium, you need a decent football setup, but just as importantly, you need a good chief executive, you need a good management team. Richard, you're effectively saying that they're a bit thin on the ground at the moment, even in the Premier League. Keith, can you take us through why that aspect of the running of clubs is so important?
Is so poor or so important?
So important.
And so poor.
And so poor.
I think the great shame is that, to use your analogy, David, if you take all 20 together, they would qualify to be in the FTSE 100. You wouldn't say that the management, I'm assuming, generally speaking, the FTSE 100 has certainly a management structure, not always the people in place, but a management structure of desire. And the clubs seem to have gone from corner shops to department stores almost overnight, and they're still run in an old-fashioned way. Terrible technology by and large, really poor succession, still a key relationship being the chairman and the manager, without any thought about the improvements that there are now in the measurement of player performances, the technical, medical, and all those issues. And I think, actually, to an extent, that's one of the reasons why we lag, especially when we play European teams.
But if you take just the chief executive role, Keith, is it top flight football's inability to attract good people, or is it football's lager mentality that keeps good people out?
If you take a comparison with a company in any other industry, when things go materially wrong, who gets the sack? It's the chief executive. The chief executive is a title in football. It's not a role. If things go wrong in football, he's not the guy that gets the sack. It's the manager who gets the sack. And then you take an example of a club like Arsenal, where the board of directors really is now, let's say, I don't want to be too rude, but a little bit past its best, shall we say. The guy that runs practically every aspect of it is also in his late 60s, but he's the manager. And that's an unusual environment to run a business, because he's not going to be out selling shirts and mugs and the like. So I think that there's been one chief executive, one club with a chief executive that I think you take your hat off to over the years. Manchester United had Martin Edwards, who did a superb job. He was replaced after Peter Kenyon came and left and went to Chelsea by David Gill, who's likewise done a very good job. You look around, most of the other clubs actually have a chief executive who's an administrator, maybe an operator, but not a chief executive. And part and parcel of it is that something of the order of 80%, maybe more, of the revenues these clubs earn, the chief executive doesn't generate. They're generated by a body, which is the Premier League, who have really excellent management people.
Okay, Richard, what do the clubs need to do to professionalise?
Wow, how long have we got? What do they need to do? They need to introduce a business structure throughout the entire club. So that includes first team, that includes academy from under nines upwards, in order to ensure that actually they have the best people in each and every role. And the one thing that we do in England that they don't do, certainly in Spain, is that if you're a really good under 21 coach or a really good under 14 coach, then in England, if he was a really good under 14 coach, we'd then make sure that he was with the under 18s the year afterwards. And he may not be equipped to be an under 18 coach. In Spain, what do? They keep him as an under 14 coach, but they actually pay him more because he's so good. And so what happens is the kids that come through, and they come through from the academies, is that they develop with the best coaches at their age groups. Now, in terms of youth structures, the one club that I think is really going to come on extremely strong in the next few years is at the Etihad, and it's partly for financial reasons, yes, but it's also because they introduced one position within the organization, and that was a director of coaching. They went and got a guy who had formerly been at Barcelona. He had also been over here at one other club. He'd been let go. They took him. And his job is not to coach any of the kids. His job is to coach the coaches, to tell them how to coach the kids. And he was in charge of the coaches. And the improvements that have been seen from under 9s, under 10s, under 11s up, are just dramatic. And that is what clubs need to give thought to that. They need to give thought to, are these coaches the best? Is the chief executive really a chief executive? Or do we need to go and get a proper chief executive?
I think one of it's 20 years since I've worked for a football club. And in that time, it was a London club, gone from cottage industry to, sort of Mega Millions. What's interesting is when you work for a club, there's so many people who get caught up in the sort of roller coaster results. No one thinks strategically. No one thinks long term. Too many chief executives act like the players. They want to be on the pictures. They lose, the disappointed. Long term strategy, like Richard said, you go put in a business template to look forward. Very few people are doing that. Manchester City are way ahead of most clubs on that.
I mean, I think the other thing is that on Monday before the Iceland game, and I don't know him at all, but Martin Glenn, chief executive of the FA, is in a tracksuit and sort of is mingling with the backroom staff and the players. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, that should just not happen. He's the chief executive of the FA. I mean, that's irrespective of the day after the game. He says, I don't know anything about football. But, I mean, that should just not happen. That is not the way to behave.
There was one chief executive, and what the hell, why not say it? I wrote it in the Times. Christian Perslow at Liverpool. The players called him Forrest Gump for his habit of putting himself in the centre of every picture. Now, how can you run a club? How can you run a business like that?
So, clearly, executive management of football clubs has got a long way to go. Now, is part of the issue here, I mean, I think five of the Premier League clubs are owned by Americans. The overall foreign composition is about 10 or 11 now, I think, Keith. To put the question bluntly, do you think that the overseas buyers coming in have failed to understand what is a fairly quirky industry?
Yeah, there's that great old expression of people separated by the same, by the common language, isn't there? And you bear in mind that the Americans that are brought here, most of them have had some experience of running or being investors in sports franchises. So that's the first difference. In America, they're franchises. They are, they're businesses, but they are franchises. So if they want to take them from St. Louis to back to, in the case of the Rams, back to LA, they can do it. Drop of a hat, they can do it. They are used to having an environment without relegation. They've never got to grips with relegation, ever. The risks, I think they've paid lip service to. And I think what is attracting them now is not the level of sterling against the dollar. I mean, that's that happens to have been a very comforting factor that's just crept in, is the fact that there are now proper payments in place to mitigate the risk of relegation. But more importantly, there is this huge gap between the wages they can pay and, as you said, the bottom earnings. So I've only seen one budget for a Premier League club going in the season just starting, which is less than £40 million for this season. And that means you've really, truly got to have lousy management to lose money on that. You truly have to. So for the first time, they can see a sports industry which does resemble, in that respect, what they have in the United States. And at the same time, they've been fed a diet over the last 5 or 6 years, superbly enhanced by NBC's coverage in their own country, of seeing the Premier League being played. Whereas, I'm afraid, again, without being disrespectful, the MLS is still a game which is somewhere below, just below our league system, I would say, in terms of quality.
I cheat and steal. I said, welcome to my world.
I also think, David, as well, is that I don't think they really understand what they are letting themselves in for when they come. They don't really understand what it's all about. It's like us. If we went to buy an NFL team or a baseball team, we may watch the sport on TV and we may say, oh, he hits the ball a long way, or he can throw the ball a long way. But we don't understand all of the ins and outs and the draft procedure. I mean, there is a famous incident of two U.S. owners who, when they met with the first team manager at the end of the season, after the final day of the season, and they said, don't worry about it at all. You're going to have £50 million to spend. They'd been at the club for over 12 months by this time as well. You're going to have over £50 million to spend. And once we've exhausted that money, we're going to go straight to the draft. And that's an absolutely true story.
That's, I mean, George would never have said that, surely. I think that there's a little bit more as well, and the deal that got Premier League approval today that we were talking about earlier, one of the buyers is a group, two Americans in particular, but one of them is the principal owner of an MLS team, so he actually knows the not just a sport.
This is the chap that owns DC United.
DC United, yes. Yeah, he owns DC United with a group of others. One of whom is the prince, for the time being, the principal owner of Inter Milan. So there is the football culture running through his veins. We started talking to him last September. He's been here. He's studied it. He's gone through every nuance. But he actually knows the game. He knows the feeling of not in that sport, but during the course of this year, Swansea had a rough ride. So he felt relegation, the risk of relegation. And I think what you're going to see is a more enlightened American looking now at our sports businesses.
Can I just pick you up on that, Keith? What you've just effectively said was it took the thick end of 10 months to conclude that deal on Swansea, and I know you've been involved in a deal on a London club that I think took even longer.
Why do
these deals take so long?
When I put together a little sales pack, rather glibly, I used to put down as one of the advantages, single owner. Never has an advantage been so understated, because when you have more than one owner, they all have their own views. Psychologically, one game to the next, they're going to win the league, they're going to get relegated. And they all change. They all change. So there are protracted talks that go on. In the case of Crystal Palace, which took 2 years, there were a whole host of other reasons, some of which can't be discussed because they're to do with litigation. In the case of Everton, it was done slowly, and then all in 3 weeks. So it's the nature of the beast, I think.
Just maybe one more question on the Premier League. Use a few minutes perhaps for anyone who has questions of the panellists. But keep mentioning this new TV rights deal. Beyond 2019, Keith, you've been involved in these types of rights negotiations. I'm sure, Richard, you have as well. Do you continue to see these rights monies going up?
I think they'll go up. Whether they'll go up by another 70%, I don't know. But I think there are a whole host of reasons for them going up. Tony mentioned one, and that is there are broadcast players that haven't yet gone into it. The second is that BT has basically based its entire marketing budget for its broadband offering and its upcoming mobile phone offering on sport. They are approximately 3.5 to 4 times the size of Sky. Sky, I would say, is probably 80 or 85% identified with its sports offering. So nobody can afford to lose it. BT, halfway through a marketing program and can afford it. Sky, the share price would collapse. But there are other players. I think had it not been for the shenanigans in Qatar, we would have seen the Qatari player this time round, next time round, possibly. So that's one thing. The other is there are international markets, and this is where China does have a role to play, with about 15 or 16% of the world's population. Frankly, the rights are not being sold expensively into Sky. That's the second. I think the third is there are a whole host of new media. The likes of Amazon, Netflix, live streaming that we haven't seen yet. And what we do know is they have vast sums of money, these companies, held outside the United States. If they repatriate them to the US, they're going to pay huge taxes, and they are chasing media deals. So you put all that, and then there's just one other stat to bear in mind, and that is we still sell our domestic rights at a fraction of the cost that the NFL charges for its domestic rights for about a third of the games. So I think there's still huge pressure to push rights valuations up.
I agree with all of that. I don't think the increase will be as great as it has been this time round, but it certainly will not go down.
I'm not so sure. It might be more. One of the interesting things is that the big media companies have been, one in particular was talking about getting involved last time round, but they didn't have the platforms. With the advent of 5G and streaming on devices getting ever cheaper, then they believe that they can get into the vast Asian markets where they can market the games very, very cheaply, yet the volume will make them huge amounts of money. And so I think they will go up. I think the next deal will be absolutely mind-boggling.
Anybody want to throw in any questions from anywhere? Well, Keith, you know Karen Brady, so that puts you right on the spot.
I thought we're supposed to know the questions in advance. Karen's done a fine job. She did an amazing job, frankly, at Birmingham, because she didn't have much of a product to market. Gritty, determined, with difficult bosses. Owners, bosses. I sold Birmingham when they were there. They are tough taskmasters. She did a wonderful job. I think she went into West Ham with probably with less interest because it's not an easy job by any means. And public spotlight and everything else. And then of course she got maybe a little bit distracted by by television and by her ennoblement. But all that said, someone has steered West Ham as the cheapest tenant of the largest sporting arena in Europe, and I suspect she had quite a lot to do with that. So is that a satisfactory answer? Unless you're her son, of course.
With what we, you know, a lot of the problems that you've seen with owners that have entered the Premier League and took over clubs, and the fans and the protests and things that you see, at what point do you think the government need to step in and put some sort of protection in place, like what Germany has, to try and prevent, you know, these renegade owners coming in and just ripping up the rule book?
The horse has bolted, I think. It should have been done years ago. I mean, I've long sort of suggested, talked to people within football, campaign for what it's worth, that football clubs should have a, like, list of buildings. They should have an element which recognises their involvement in the community around them and all that. But I think that's all over. I don't think we'll never get a situation again like we had in the 90s, I think, with the Glazers and Gillette and Hicks, you know, threatening, in theory, the very existence of clubs, because things like the Premier League salary cap and some of the rules the Premier League have put in protect that. But yeah, I'm afraid those days have gone. I think we've seen the best of it all that way.
I think we need to look at the fit and proper persons test, because as far as I'm aware, there may be one other, because I'm trying to think of the other name, but I think there's actually only one person who has ever failed that test, which is Stephen Vaughan at Stockport County. So if you can have someone from Thailand who is convicted of war crimes, who is said to be a fit and proper person to own a club, then I think it's really fair game, and I'd love to know what Stephen Vaughan did that was so wrong.
I can tell you that having just gone through the most recent and the two that preceded it, most recent fit and proper, the owners and directors tests, as it's known, it is much more vigorous now, rigorous and vigorous. And part of it, of course, is that the Premier League had a huge embarrassment in the time when Portsmouth were being relegated, when a fellow who was approved actually didn't exist, who was the chap Al Farage or something, right? There was no such person. That's one thing. So it is much more rigorous, vigorous, and appropriate. The other is a little bit of protection. Again, this is recent. So Swansea, when they were 15 years ago on the verge of leaving professional football, some guys got together. Some of them did it individually. The guy that I think is one of the finest chairmen is a fellow called Hugh Jenkins. He was a builder and a roofer, and he'd been doing work on the old stadium. And if any of you had ever been to the old Swansea Stadium, it really was an old stadium. One side of it was a prison. It was a very difficult place. And he actually couldn't be paid, so he took shares. So that's how he got his shares. But then a bunch of people, about 70 or 80, formed a supporters trust. And they put some money in, and they took just over 21% of that club. And people said, well, maybe when, you know, the clubs are down in the dumps, it's appropriate to have a supporters trust. Well, guess what? They've gone all the way through the ranks. They're now 7 or 8 years in the Premier League. And the Americans that are buying it are leaving the supporters in place with a 21% share and a seat on the board. And I think that's probably not a bad model, provided it's a broad church, this supporters trust. Some of them you wouldn't want in your living room. Others are very high quality people. And some of them can't be in your living room because every now and again they're in that building that was alongside the old ground. So anyway, that's one of those things. That is football. But by and large, if you put all that together, I think that's a very good check and balance, because unlike the ownership structures of a lot of clubs, we don't have restrictions. But I think, you know, we have a free market, and that's, so you have to play by that. But there's nothing to say that a club being sold doesn't have to have all the shares being accepted, all the shareholders accepting a bid. And in this case, it was made absolutely clear right at the outset that the supporters of Swansea in the Trust were going to remain after the takeover.
One more question, I think we've then got to stop. For me, the gentleman up here.
Why aren't Premier League clubs doing more about ticket prices being so high, particularly away tickets, considering their huge revenues?
Well, one owner said to me, he said, given that match day revenue is a shrinking proportion of overall income, he said, like, you know, yeah, ticket prices should come down. And then the same owner put the ticket prices up. Basically, she agreed. And of course, they'll always tell you the story that they needed to pay the players' wages and all that. It isn't. It's simply greed. There is no reason for the ticket prices to be at this level they are now. And this is an area where the governments, well, actually, where Richard Scudamore, the Premier League, should step in. And what he should do is try and force through some sort of agreement where they bring down prices. The problem is getting 14 Premier League chairmen and owners to agree on anything is, like, I don't know, nearly impossible. You know, unless there's money in it for them, and there's no money in it for them here.
I have heard at Premier League level that Premier League get that the fans who go to matches are part of the show. That's not going to suggest that they're going to start paying the fans to go, but maybe there's a creeping realisation they need to do something about ticket prices.
Well, and there is now a cap on away ticket prices.
Right. Hello? Is this one mic'd up? No. Hey, guys, I've got to cut you off now. Fantastic. Thank you for that that discussion. You're going to have to kind of... Yes, you're going to have to continue it in the bar because we have another guest. We're nipping in very quickly before the next session. Before you go, you're welcome to stay here and drink, but I just need one of the mics. Now, look, I just wanted to... We didn't properly explain why this is called the Tea Party Tent. It's a very simple nod to Alice in Wonderland. We're through the looking glass, you know, kind of... You know, every asset price in the world seems to be mispriced. Money's free. We no longer have a political class. It's chaos, hence the Tea Party. There is cake next door, which are all... We had a technical issue by not having plates, but if you, I was assured that somebody was getting some, but